and welcome to the April episode of the EVJ Conversation Podcast. I'm your host, Rhiannon Morgan. Today we're highlighting the special focus on equine endocrinology issue that EVJ has released in March. As part of this special focus, Nicola Menzies-Gow, a professor of equine medicine at the Royal Veterinary College, has produced the Beaver Primary Care Guidelines on Diagnosis and Management of Equine Pituitary Pars Intermedia Dysfunction, and has joined the podcast to talk us through the research. Nicola, thanks very much for joining us to discuss this new Beaver Care Clinical Guidelines study in EVJ. This large-scale review of literature concerning PPID, or equine pituitary pars intermedia dysfunction, aims to develop evidence-based primary care guidelines for the diagnosis and treatment of equine PPID based on the available literature. So could you start by giving us a quick review of what PPID is and what we know about it so far?
So, as you've already said, PPID stands for pituitary pars intermedia dysfunction, and it's one of those diseases that's had lots of different names historically. So I think the name people most know it by from before is equine Cushing's disease. But it got decided that that was an incorrect term because it's not the same as Cushing's disease in dogs or people, which is an adrenal-dependent disease. In the horse, PPID is entirely pituitary-dependent. So the pituitary gland obviously is a small gland at the base of the brain that is there regardless of the species, and it's divided into different areas. One of the areas is known as the pars intermedia, hence the PPID part. And what happens in horses with PPID is that this area of the pituitary loses its normal dopaminergic inhibition from the hypothalamus. So it loses its off switch or its inhibitory switch. It still has the stimulation that comes from the hypothalamus, which is from stimulation via 5-HT or serotonin, but it loses that inhibition. The area doesn't have negative feedback from the hormones it produces or the hormones downstream that come from the adrenal gland, for example. So the entire inhibition of this area comes from the hypothalamus and is lost. So in losing that inhibition, it means that there is overproduction of the normal hormones that this area would produce. There's not production of abnormal hormones, different hormones, etc. It's the normal ones that produce, but just too much of it. And they then end up in the circulation and result, well, we presume they result in the clinical signs that you see, but we don't actually know exactly how the vast majority of the clinical signs manifest. We presume they're a result of the overproduction of these pituitary devised hormones, but we don't know for sure. We assume it. And then you see the array of clinical signs that we do. And the way that we test for it is by measuring concentrations of the pituitary-derived hormone, ACTH. It's a little bit sort of confusing in so much that the ACTH isn't the major product via the pars intermedia. It produces more of other hormones such as beta-endorphin, alpha-MSH, which is melanocyte-stimulating hormone, and other hormones such as CLIP, which is this corticotropin-like intermediate peptide. The area does produce a small amount of ACTH, but a different area of the pituitary is responsible for most of the production of the ACTH. But that said, it's the hormone that we have that we can measure in the commercial laboratory setting. So we use that essentially as a proxy measure of the overproduction of hormones in the pituitary to make a diagnosis of PPID. Or we do something that's called a TRH stimulation test, which is thyrotropin-releasing hormone, which is essentially a physiologic release factor for the pituitary. So it stimulates the pituitary to release all its hormones, but we just happen to measure the ACTH release in response to the TRH. And we use both of those tests to try and make a diagnosis of PPID in conjunction with the clinical signs that the horse is displaying. And the likelihood of the disease occurring based on the age of the horse, etc. And we know that these tests aren't perfect, as we'll go on to discuss, I'm sure. They don't get the answer right in every time, and there are quite large grey zones in these test results, which makes the diagnosis of the disease quite difficult, which is particularly important when we're thinking of it being a lifelong condition. The treatment that we're going to use only helps manage the condition. It doesn't cure the condition. So it's important that we try and get the correct diagnosis before we commit these horses to having lifelong therapy.
Well, thank you for that explanation. So this study brought together a large panel of experts to study the quality of evidence on the topic, highlighting specific questions to be answered by the research available. So how did you manage this, and what guidelines did you use to systematically go through this process?
So it was quite a long process, as I'm sure you will appreciate. I was asked initially by the editor of EBJ at Quadrant New Journal to be the panel chair for the topic. And the topic was nominated by various BEVA, so British Equine Veterinary Association committees. They have the Committee for Clinical Practice, Health and Medicine, and Ethics and Welfare and Equestrian Sports. And also it was done in consultation with the BEVA members at the annual Congress in 2021. Members were asked to nominate topics that they thought would be of use to them if some kind of guidelines were produced. So one of those topics that was asked for was PPID. And then we had to put together a panel. So rather than it just being me doing all the work and just giving my opinions, it was a panel. And the BEVA has guidelines for these panels to try and ensure that the panel is representative both of the veterinary population and also not just entirely UK-based. So the panel included people that were working in first opinion equine veterinary practice, because what they need is very different from what we might imagine as people working in research. And also recommendations are there's at least one international expert on the panel as well, to ensure that you get sort of a balanced input from worldwide research rather than it just being an entirely UK-focused panel. So we came up with a number of people that we thought would be appropriate to be on the panel. We contacted them, and fortunately, all of them agreed. So we ended up with 8 people on the panel. We then met and each panel member was asked to nominate clinical questions. So questions that they thought people working in first opinion equine veterinary practice would like the answer to. They'd like to know, is there any research out there to support me undertaking this test or me using this treatment in this particular animal, etc. So we all nominated clinical questions, and we all gave input into the questions to try and sort of improve them and ensure that we were happy with all of them. And the first thing that we decided that was important to consider is which animals should be tested for PPID, because essentially that's a background question, but it's probably the most important question, because we don't want to test horses unnecessarily. So we initially answered that question, and then we grouped the actual sort of clinically relevant question into 4 categories. We grouped them into categories of diagnostic accuracy of the available tests in animals with different pretest probabilities of having PPID, and we define that as low, moderate, and high pretest probability, based on our answering of our background question. Second group was interpretation of the diagnostic tests. Then we had looked at pharmacological agents for the medical management of PPID and their side effects, and then any other treatment or management options. And then our final category was monitoring of cases that were being treated with pergolide. Once we got our very long list of questions, each question category, so we had 4 categories, was allocated to 2 of the panel members, because we had 8 panel members. And then within that, we then had to change these clinical questions into what are called PICO questions. And that's a well-recognized way of trying to sort of standardize the way you answer these questions. So PICO stands for, the P is the population, the I is intervention, the C is comparison, and the O is outcome. And then we sort of tweaked those variously. So for example, a PICO question might be something like, does treatment of horses with PPID with pergolide result in an improvement in the clinical signs compared to using no treatment whatsoever? For example, and we had a very long list of questions that we were going to answer. And when you're considering the outcome wasn't the same for each of the questions, because it depended on what the actual question was. So it might be things like, does whatever you're trying to do, does it improve the clinical signs, or does it decrease the ACTH concentrations? Does it improve fertility, etc.? So the outcome was sort of individualized to each question. And then we had one extra question that didn't fit into our four categories nicely, just to be a little bit difficult. So our extra question was, are equids with PPRD and insulin dysregulation at an increased risk of laminitis compared to equids with PPRD but without insulin dysregulation? Because we felt that this was quite an important part of PPRD that people worry about a lot, because obviously laminitis is the clinical sign that has the biggest impact on an animal's quality of life and also long-term outlook, really. We then presented the questions to an online webinar that was open to all Beaver members that could comment if they wanted to, but we got quite a lot of discussion, but we didn't get any sort of direct alteration to our questions based on that. So then, having finalized our questions that we wanted to answer, we had to start searching the literature. So we used a standardized process to search the literature, which is called the GRADE process, which is a well-known sort of formal process of searching the literature. And essentially, we searched all the literature. We didn't limit publication date, so it could date back to 1920 or whatever. We didn't limit the study population, apart from the study population that was involved in the study had to include horses and ponies. We didn't include any studies that just had donkeys or other exotic equids such as zebras, etc. in them. The only thing we excluded was individual case reports. We did include sort of case series, etc. We didn't have any other limitations on study design. And although not peer-reviewed, we did include conference proceedings. Some of the other guidelines that have been drawn up did not include conference proceedings simply because they weren't peer-reviewed. But as long as they were available online, we did include that, because otherwise we felt that we would be excluding quite a lot of abstracts, for example, from the Global Equine Endocrinology Symposia and the Havemeyer conferences. We then searched the databases. We focused on PubMed and CabDirect databases. We did the searches between April 2022 and August 2022, and then we redid the searches again in January 23 before we started actually writing the document to ensure that we picked up anything new that had been published. We retrieved all the records using our search terms, removed any duplicates, and then we extracted the data from each of those publications by each researcher using a standard extraction form. So essentially we recorded everything from each publication and then collated it together. And then you have to sort of assess the quality of the evidence that you find for each question. So you can see it's quite a long procedure. And the GRADE process, so the official process, has four levels of evidence or certainty of the evidence or the quality of the evidence, from very low, low, moderate and high, with evidence from randomized controlled trials being high quality and evidence that includes just observational data at low quality. And I'm sure you can imagine that the evidence within the PPRD literature, that the vast majority of it is low or very low. There are no randomized controlled clinical trials out there. And then you have various sort of criteria by which you increase or decrease the sort of certainty of your evidence, including whether the study might be biased, etc. And then once you've graded the quality of the evidence, then you make recommendations based on that evidence, which can either be strong or weak. You only have two categories. And strong is basically that all or almost all people would choose to do that. For example, you decide that the evidence is strong that treating with pergolide improves clinical signs. So yes, that's strong evidence for that. You would go with that. Or weak evidence, weak recommendations imply that there's probably quite a lot of variation in what the individual people would decide because the evidence isn't that great. So we graded all the publications, and then we came up with recommendations, etc., for all the different individual questions. And then, having got to the end of that, then obviously we had to write the whole document, and the whole document was written. It was a combination of effort from all the different panel members. So each sort of group of two wrote their sections for the document, and then we put it all together to make a sort of a coherent manuscript that ended up getting peer reviewed. So there were two peer reviewers. It was an open process. The peer reviewers weren't blinded to us, and we weren't blinded to them. Everyone knew who each other was, which is different to EBJ's normal process. But having responded to the reviewers' comments, got it to the point that they were happy with, then it then got published, and so then here we are talking about it.
That sounds like a huge amount of work.
It was a lot of work. It's not a quick job to do these things.
So let's go through these sections and discuss the research questions associated with each and what you found. So I'll start off with your first section, case selection for diagnostic testing, pretest probability and diagnostic test accuracy. So you reviewed a variety of clinical signs. Which did you find affected pretest probability?
So the only signs that we found evidence for that gives you a high index of clinical suspicion are those associated with changes in hair coat. So either current or historical hypertrichosis, so essentially being a long hair coat or delayed or incomplete hair shedding, those kind of things. So those were the only signs that gave you sort of a high clinical index. Then there were a lot of other signs that sort of were in the moderate category. So we had things like laminitis, weight loss, polyuria, polydipsia, hyperhidrosis, bulging supraorbital fat pads, recurrent infections, etc. There was quite a large sort of group that fell in that. And then there was a whole load of signs that had a very low suspicion of having it. But what we also decided and discovered that essentially you have to interpret these clinical signs in combination with the horse's age and the sort of what we call the pretest probability of that particular horse being likely to have the disease. So obviously horses as they get older are more likely to have PPRD. So you're a horse that's 20 with sort of clinical signs that are sort of a much lower suspicion, you're going to be more likely to test or think about it than a horse that's only 7 that's got these low clinical suspicion signs. So you have to put, what we learned is that you, as we already suspected, is that you have to put it all together. You can't just go on the clinical signs by themselves. You have to look at the whole horse and put it in the context of its age and how likely it is to have the disease, as to whether you then should go forward and do the test for PPRD or you should consider other disease processes before you jump to your PPRD testing.
Okay, and that makes perfect sense. So you also looked at how the season affected the accuracy of basal ACTH testing alongside the clinical signs that they were showing. So what combination of pretesting probability and season did you find provided the most accurate results?
So we found that both the pretest probability, i.e. having a low, moderate or high pretest probability, and the season had a strong influence on the ability to diagnose the PPRD using both basal ACTH and also the ACTH after a TRH stimulation test. So, for example, the overall diagnostic accuracy of the basal ACTH ranged between 88 and 92% in the autumn, whereas in the non-autumn, it was lower. We're down at 70 to 86%. So we've gone from getting it right 9 out of 10 times to only getting it right 7 out of 10 times for the basal ACTH. There was a lot less evidence for the ACTH response to TRH. There was far fewer publications that are out there, I think probably because we've been measuring the ACTH in response to TRH. More recently, historically, people measured cortisol response to it, but for this study we only looked at the ACTH response to TRH because that's the current recommendations, and we only had a single study that gave us the diagnostic accuracy for ACTH in response to TRH, and this was at the 30 minute point. Not, some people take samples after 10 minutes after giving the TRH, but there's only published evidence for the 30 minutes. And in the autumn, the accuracy was between 92 and 98%. So that's pretty good. And then it decreased, but not nearly so much to between 90 and 94% in the non-autumn, depending on the pretest probability. So We've got to remember that the risk of a false positive result does increase in situations where there's a low pretest probability. So you might start lifelong therapy unnecessarily. So you just need to be mindful that the test doesn't give you the correct answer every time. So that if your test result doesn't fit what you're seeing in the horse, then don't rely entirely on the test result. Put it together with the rest of the horse.
Okay, brilliant. Moving on to interpretation of test results. So in this section, factors that may affect the diagnostic test result were reviewed. And these included elements such as whether the horse was fed or starved, was suffering from systemic disease, had received repeat TRH doses, their body condition score, stress, laminitis, acute pain, dynamic insulin testing, being debilitated, and being based in a certain latitude and coat colour. So which of these did you find made a significant difference on basal ACTH concentration or on the ACTH response to TRH administration?
So for a lot of those, we didn't find any evidence simply because the questions were very specific. I mean, they were very specific on purpose because people want to know, do I feed it or do I starve it before I do my test, etc. But the honest answer is for a lot of those, people just haven't done the study, so the evidence isn't out there to let you know. The ones that we did find some evidence for is that there is a significant effect of breed on plasma ACTH concentrations, so the basal ACTH, and particularly in the autumn, with the concentrations of the ACTH being much higher in some, but not all, thrifty breeds. But exactly what the definition of a thrifty breed is probably a bit open to interpretation as well. That makes it slightly more difficult. We found that both the basal and the post-TRH ACTH concentrations might be affected by latitude or geographic location, by diet and feeding, by coat colour, by critical illness, by trailer transport. So I guess it's just you have to remember that lots of different things will impact on the measurement, some of which you can control, i.e. don't trailer transport immediately before you're going to measure your ACTH, some of which you can't control, like you can't change the horse's coat colour, and we don't have reference ranges for every single colour of the rainbow that a horse might come in. But just to remember that all of these things added together may have an impact. The biggest one that people want to know about is pain. They want to know whether if the horse has acute laminitis, should we be testing now or should we wait? And we found that mild pain, and there was one study out there that did specifically look at horses that had laminitis, and then they used them as their own control by giving them analgesia and then repeating the ACTH concentrations. They found that mild pain is unlikely to have a large effect on basal ACTH, but caution might be required for more severe pain. But I would hope that most of the occasions in which you're going to be measuring ACTH where there's pain involved, it's going to be associated with the laminitis rather than anything else. To remember that we can't possibly have a diagnostic threshold for every single factor so that you can look up your combination of things that occur in your individual animal and go, hey presto, this is the right diagnostic threshold for this individual animal because its coat colour is grey and it lives in Glasgow and it has eaten 3 hours ago, etc. So I think that's what contributes to us having what we call equivocal ranges. So we have ranges in which we know that and can be confident that it doesn't have PFPID. We can have ranges in which we can be confident that it does. And then quite a big bit in the middle that people call equivocal ranges, grey zone, whatever you want to call it, in which it might have it. And I think we just have to be comfortable with the fact that it's not a cut and dry answer, yes or no. It is a sliding scale of certainty based on lots of different contributing factors. The one thing that we did look at when it comes to sort of combining tests with the tests for insulin dysregulation, because that's quite a common thing you want to do, because that animal having insulin dysregulation makes it more likely to get laminitis and have a poorer prognosis. So we found that dynamic insulin testing and TRH stimulation testing can be combined. but you shouldn't do the TRH stimulation immediately after the oral sugar test for the insulin dysregulation. So you just make sure that you don't follow the oral sugar test immediately after. So that's the only caveat that we found as far as the timing of the testing was concerned.
Just looping back to the effect of pain on testing, would you advise to get on top of laminitis and the pain before testing then?
I think in an ideal world, it would be better because then you can be absolutely sure that the pain isn't having any input whatsoever. But certainly I think with the study that's out there where they did look at the effect of pain and these animals did have laminitis and then they used them as their own control and demonstrated that it didn't have any effect, then I think we can be more confident that it's okay because it varies from situation to situation, doesn't it? Sometimes you're happy to wait and it's not going to influence what you do, but other times when the owner really wants to know or it's going to influence what you do clinically or the horse isn't responding to your standard laminitis treatment and you hope by seeing whether it does or doesn't have an endocrine disease and you add in that therapy that it might just help improve things. So I think if you can wait, it's better. But if the circumstances mean that waiting isn't really an option, I think we can be relatively confident that the laminitis pain isn't going to negatively impact our test result and cause us to come up with an incorrect result.
Okay, so moving on to your third section, pharmacological treatments and other treatment management options. Did you find sufficient evidence to suggest Perglide does improve clinical signs seen with PPID?
So yes, we were confident that Perglide improves most clinical signs in most animals. So it's not perfect. It doesn't work in every single animal, but it certainly there is enough evidence out there for us to be happy that, yes, it is the right therapy for the vast majority of animals. So you're only going to know when you start the therapy in that animal whether it's going to fall into that category of majority. But I think you can be confident that it should work in most animals.
Did you find that it did reduce basal ACTH concentrations or the ACTH response to TRH?
So yes, again, there was good evidence to suggest that it lowers both the basal ACTH and improves the ACTH response to TRH in many animals, but again, not all. So you just have to remember that caveat that it might not work in all animals. But again, the thing to remember is that there is no evidence that measures of insulin dysregulation are improved. So don't expect the Perglide to improve that aspect of the PPID. You're going to have to do other measures to improve the insulin dysregulation with sort of low glycemic diet, improving the exercise, obviously, when their feet are better, if they have laminitis, etc. So Perglide seems to work well on and improving the clinical signs and also the sort of laboratory measures for PPID, but not the insulin dysregulation part of PPID.
And does Perglide paste or compounded Perglide make any difference?
There was no evidence to suggest either way, to be honest. There were no studies out there that allowed us to answer that question. So I don't know.
And other therapies, did Chaseberry or cypraheptadine have different effects to Perglide?
So the Chaseberry had no effect on the ACTH concentrations. And also there was no benefit of adding the Chaseberry to the Perglide therapy. So it doesn't seem to be an alternative to Perglide, and it certainly doesn't seem to have an additional effect. So to be honest, I think you're better off concentrating on the Perglide therapy. And there was no evidence to say that combination of cypraheptadine with the Perglide was superior to Perglide alone. So again, Perglide comes out as the single best therapy for the condition.
And did Perglide improve fertility or reduce the risk of agalactia?
There were no studies that looked at that. So that wasn't a question that we could answer, unfortunately.
Okay. And is that the same with harmful cardiac effects?
No, there were actually, surprisingly, there were two studies that looked at that. And in both of those, there was no evidence that the pergolide had the harmful cardiac effects. So there is evidence in people that it does. But certainly in those two studies, obviously two studies, small number of animals, but certainly in those studies, there was no evidence that it had any adverse cardiac effects. So I think we can at least use it confidently as far as we're aware that it doesn't have those effects.
Okay, and moving on to your last section, so monitoring treated cases. So when reviewing the different types of monitoring, such as basal ACTH measurements, clinical signs, ACTH responses, etc., which option did you find most accurate?
So the conclusions we came to was that the hormone assays, so both the basal ACTH or your ACTH response to TH, give you a crude indication of pituitary control in response to pergolide therapy. But there was no evidence to suggest whether sort of close monitoring of the ACTH or titrating the dose of pergolide according to the response was associated with either improved endocrinological, so laboratory control, or a clinical outcome, unfortunately. So there was just not enough evidence out there for us to draw that conclusion to say that sort of close monitoring, or it's better to monitor this way or that way. So it's a question that still needs answering, unfortunately.
So what did you find was the best time of year to assess the clinical and endocrine responses?
So there was only one publication that was relevant to the question. And when pergolide therapy was initiated in the autumn, the ACTH concentrations did not improve substantially until the winter. So whilst assessment of ACTH concentrations is typically advocated sort of in the spring and autumn, i.e. monitoring them every 6 months, although it's logical, there isn't any evidence to say that it's associated with an improved outcome. So again, it's one of those questions that we haven't got the evidence to say what's better. So yes, in theory, spring and autumn is good, but you could pick other times of the year, and we have no evidence to say that anything is better than another choice.
Okay. And should fecal worm egg counts or other systemic markers of organ dysfunction be monitored alongside this testing?
So the second part is easy to answer. So we looked to see whether there was any sort of evidence of needing to look at markers of hepatic or renal or any other organ dysfunction. And there were no studies that had looked at that. So we don't know for that one. When it comes to the worm egg count, there were two publications where they looked and they did show that one of them showed that horses with PPRD had higher fecal worm egg counts both before and after pergolide treatment compared to some healthy controls. But in the second study, there was no difference between the PPRD horses and the not. So the evidence is limited, two studies which contradict each other. So maybe horses are more likely to shed their eggs than the others. But I think there's not enough evidence at the moment again.
Okay, and lastly, going on to the extra question that didn't fit into any of your categories, was the risk of laminitis higher in animals with PPID plus or minus insulin dysregulation?
So we had more studies to help us with this one. So we had 9 sort of full publications and 1 abstract. And they revealed that animals with PPID and hyperinsulinemia, so that being the manifestation of insulin dysregulation, do appear to be at a higher risk of laminitis than those with PPID alone without any evidence of insulin dysregulation. But the direct sort of causal association between the PPID and the insulin dysregulation remains unclear. And it certainly seems to be that neither ACTH concentration or clinical signs of PPID are sort of insulin independent predictors of laminitis risk. So it seems to be that the insulin dysregulation itself is the thing that's driving the laminitis risk and therefore the poorer prognosis. But exactly how the PPRD is causing the insulin dysregulation is still to be determined. And whether the insulin dysregulation is a direct result of the PPRD or is occurring for some other reason, do they have concurrent equine metabolic syndrome, et cetera, is still to be determined as well. So yes, if they have, the short answer is, if they have ID as well as PPRD, then that's bad news. But it's not necessarily the PPRD that is directly driving the ID. And certainly we found that the pergolide isn't affecting the ID. So you need to look for it separately and you need to manage it separately to the PPRD.
Okay, that's good to know. Did you think the aims of this review were completed? And how do you hope the evidence highlighted in this review will be implemented in clinical practice?
So I think we achieved the aims as best we could. We were never going to be able to answer all of the questions that people wanted answers to, because there simply isn't the evidence that's out there. There's a whole array of questions that people want to know because it affects the decisions that they make with clinical cases in front of them. But it's surprising how little evidence there is there out there for the sort of individual nuances of the individual cases that people want to know. So whilst we managed to answer the sort of bigger picture questions, such as does pergolide work, is it worth using it as a treatment, how good are the diagnostic tests, we didn't manage to answer sort of the more specific questions just because the literature just isn't out there. So we came away with lots of unanswered questions. I thought that was going to be the case, but then we've actually proved it, which I guess is good in a way. So it just highlights to everybody, whether they're in first opinion practice or in research, is that we don't know all the answers. We don't know everything about the disease. We don't know everything about the tests. We don't know everything about the treatment, and we don't know everything about monitoring it, which are all fairly fundamental parts of the disease process. And I guess the take-home messages are, one, we don't know all the answers. Two, the tests aren't perfect. So make sure that you consider your test result in light of how likely you think that individual animal is to have PPRD based on its age, its clinical signs, etc. And remember that the test doesn't give you the correct answer every time. We can be confident that pergolide does improve the clinical signs and the laboratory markers in most animals, but not all. And as I've said, it has no effect on the insulin dysregulation. So you need additional measures to try and improve that. And that's particularly important because it is the ID component rather than the PPRD and the ACTH, et cetera, that seem to be directly associated with the laminitis risk and therefore the worse prognosis. So don't just focus on the PPRD and the use of the pergolide. You need to think of the insulin dysregulation part equally importantly and undertake sort of management changes, et cetera, to try and improve that for the horse as well, to try and maximise its long-term prognosis and welfare.
You have some really useful tables in the paper, which will be useful for clinical practice, things showing how to weight the clinical signs and key recommendations for all these paragraphs, and some good flow diagrams. So I'd urge everyone to have a look at the paper for use in clinical practice. What do you think needs to be prioritised to be investigated further?
I think in an ideal world, if we could, we need to come up with a better diagnostic test. I think that would help us. The trouble is, even post-mortem, it's difficult to make a diagnosis. Somebody, I forget exactly when, but quite a while ago, because it didn't fall as part of this study, did a study where they sent pituitary sections to 7 different histopathologists and asked them for their opinion. Even they didn't agree when they had the whole pituitary to look at down the microscope. So if we can't agree post-mortem, when you have the pituitary on the slide in front of you, how are we ever going to find an anti-mortem test that's going to be perfect? So I think that's certainly where we struggle. We're using tests that measure hormones, for example, ACTH, that isn't sort of the major product of the pituitary pars intermedia. I mean, we're using it because it's the best that we've got. There are other things that you can measure in the research setting, but it's the only thing that we've got in the real world, in the clinical setting. But we're making a lifelong diagnosis based on an imperfect test. So I think if we could have a better diagnostic test that we could be sure of, and we could be sure of, that was getting us the right answer in the vast majority of cases, that would be a step forward, because then we would be putting the right animals on their lifelong therapy. Because I think we can be confident that pergolide is at least the best drug that we have available at the moment. I'm sure in the future there'll be other things that maybe do work better, but at least we can be confident that pergolide works in the majority of animals. But we want to make sure that we're giving it to the right animals in the first place.
You mentioned earlier some take-home messages. Did you have anything you wanted to add to them?
I don't think so. I think we've covered most of the paper. I guess it was an awful lot of work to summarise an awful lot of literature, as you probably realised, for us to realise that there are a lot of holes in the scientific literature that's out there. So a lot of the time we're making our clinical decisions based on anecdotal evidence, what we usually do, etc. And whilst in an ideal world we would make all our decisions based on evidence-based medicine, we can't do that in all aspects of when it comes to PPRD. So we can when choosing the diagnostic test, and we can in choosing the treatment, but in all the other nuances of the disease and its management and its monitoring, etc., then we're having to sort of go with what we think should work, but it would be nice if at some point in the future we had some evidence to back up that what we were doing was the right thing.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time, not only in doing this podcast, but coordinating all this research and the review and writing the paper. I'm sure it'll be very useful to everybody in clinical practice with all these questions and add some evidence to what they're doing in clinical practice. So, much appreciated, Nicola.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks again for listening, and please join us for the June episode.